at the entrance.
Welcome to the show. This is the Magician and the Fool podcast, episode number 69. My name is Dominic. I am one of the co-hosts of the show. The other host is Janus, and he will be here in just a minute. Today we had the absolute pleasure and honor of speaking once again to Professor Gregory Shaw. We first spoke to Professor Shaw way back in episode number 8, and then again in episode number 37, where we discussed the Parmenides with he and Edward Butler. Just a stellar episode. Today we discuss Professor Shaw's new book, Hellenic Tantra, The Theurgic Platonism of Iamblichus, and it is fantastic, as expected. It's a great follow-up to his work, Theurgy and the Soul, The Neoplatonism of Iamblichus, which was put out quite a few years ago. But Professor Shaw has written a lot of other papers besides those two books. You can find most, if not all of them, on academia.edu, so please go check those out. I'm going to keep this brief, as the important part is really the interview. So first, I'd like to just say thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. As always, you guys are keeping the lights on here and keeping the show rolling, so we appreciate it. If the listeners out there would like to help support this work and make sure that we are able to continue providing content, please head over to Patreon and do what makes sense to you. We dedicate this to Hermes and Asclepius. May any merits that we obtain doing this work be distributed to all sentient beings so that they, together with us, may equally realize awakening. Welcome to the show. We are extremely honored to have Professor Greg Shaw back on the show. If you're not familiar with Mr. Shaw, I would recommend going back and listening to some of our previous episodes. If you have read anything about Mediterranean philosophy, religion, mysticism, magic, pretty much a guarantee that you've seen Professor Shaw's name in the footnotes of whatever book you've been reading on the subject. So very happy to have him back here. Thank you for agreeing.
Very excited to have Greg on the show. We are so honored.
Hey, thanks, guys. Glad to be here. And thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no, it's our pleasure. Absolutely. And you've got a lot going on right now. You've got a course and you've got a new book, which is fantastic. I've had a chance to read it. It's called Hellenic Tantra, and that's going to be the main topic of today's discussion.
Great.
As well as whatever else we decide to talk about. So, Professor Shaw, let's start with the title of the book, Hellenic Tantra. Where did this come from? What does it mean? And I think that'll create a lot of different avenues for us to explore.
Early on, I don't know how early on, but at some point in when I was writing about theurgy, it occurred to me that there were some similarities between what I saw in Iamblichus's theurgical approach to the obstacles we face in our embodied life and transforming them into vehicles of liberation, and similarity between that and what I've seen in what's described as Tantra in South Asian religious traditions. And I just made note of that a few times but I didn't explore it much. And, I got an email, I don't know how many years ago, from somebody who had been reading my articles and read my book. And he said, he didn't like what I had done. He didn't appreciate my work. And he said, it's nothing else but Hellenic Tantra. And by that, I think that that was disparaging and that was a sort of dismissal of the value of it. And I thought, Hellenic Tantra, huh? You know, I kind of like the sound of that. And I decided, you know, if I'm able to pull myself together and write a book, I think that would be a great title for the book. That's where the title came from. So it's Greek. It's from the Greek tradition, Plato, Pythagoras, and all of those great Greek dudes who are associated with rationality, mathematics, and all of the stuff that we say is the glory of Western civilization, and Tantra, which still is looked upon by a lot of people in a disparaging way as just having to do with physical, embodied, sexual kinds of things with all kinds of mumbo jumbo and kind of disreputable practices. And I thought, let's put them together. And that's where the title came from.
Awesome. And I think you're right on track personally, as someone who has a practice in that realm. I've also seen those connections. And so I was extremely excited when I found out about this book and about this work. And you have written about like the Hellenic cities.
Yes.
Previously,
yes.
A very interesting right. paper there, right. which in the same vein.
Right. Right. Yeah, and that was making more explicit as I was kind of growing into this topic that the Theurgists were the Western equivalent of the Indian Siddhas, those yogis who had attained these powers and perfections, and so had the Theurgists. And so, yeah, I've been playing with that idea for quite a while.
It does make a lot of sense. So let's start. I'm just going to use your book as kind of a template mm-hmm. for the conversation.
Sure.
Non-dualism is at the beginning of the book, and it's a fantastic chapter, a lot of really interesting insights. I was wondering if you can maybe summarize your thoughts on why this idea of non-dualism is important and relevant to the topic of theurgy.
Right. Well, what I'd noticed is that a lot of scholarship on theurgy and Neoplatonism in general has tended to read it in a kind of a dualistic perspective. That the whole goal of Neoplatonism is to get out of your body and get out of this world and get up to another place called the noetic realm or the super celestial realm, but certainly not here. And there's something about the attitude that seems to be assumed by scholars is that, yeah, that's the goal. And that's the goal of theurgy too. The theurgy was a way to ascend out of this world and get into the heavenly world. And if you assume that's to be the case, then it doesn't really help us to understand what Iamblichus means when he says that the gods are willing to embody themselves through us here in this world, that this is the place where we can become deified, that that the presences of the divine are permeate the entire world around us in the form of symbols and synthemata. And they are invitations for us to realize our own divinity here in the world as embodied beings. So theoretically, that understanding of Iamblichus and theurgy doesn't jibe with the dualist sort of interpretation. But also, the fact that people like Iamblichus were looked upon and Pythagoras and Socrates for that matter were looked upon as almost embodiments of a divine presence by their followers, and they seem to have supernatural kind of powers. It was more like when people go to visit what's the name for an incarnation of God in the Eastern tradition? They have darshan with that man or woman. And simply by coming into the presence of that person, an avatar, they become elevated and transformed. And that dimension of experience is completely lacking in what scholars explore in Western and Platonic and Pythagorean tradition. And yet it was part of their tradition. But we don't recognize it because, one, we're either materialists and we don't think such things exist, or we're dualists and think if it does exist, it exists somewhere else and not here. And so I felt like that model, that dualist model or the materialist model, doesn't allow us to understand what was going on with theurgy and with this later Platonic tradition. So that's why I pushed that. And I pushed pretty hard against that scholarly tradition, suggesting basically that as long as we think of theurgy as a way to gut up and get out of this world, then we're not going to understand it. Mm-hmm. Because we're putting it into a dualist framework that it doesn't belong in. So that's what I was doing with that.
Well, and it makes me think of, you know, in the Egyptian conception, the entire body is, you know, like think of, it makes me think of, for instance, like the cannibal hymn where the initiate consumes the gods, you know, in an act of theophagy, but then the gods all become integrated into a divine body. It's kind of like the Pantheos figurines, which will have like the face of Bes and the wings of Horus and, you know, so on and so forth, because it represents all the gods as one god. And that in turn is like a manifestation of the world soul, which in turn is kind of like a cosmic form of the microcosmic personal soul.
Yeah, that's nicely said, Janice. What text was that in the Egyptian tradition that you referred to initially there? Because I want to check it out. It sounds very interesting.
I believe it's in the Cannibal Hymn.
Oh, Cannibal Hymn. Okay. Great.
Yeah, in the Cannibal Hymn, you know, the initiate goes and
eats the gods.
Yeah, he eats them, which is amazing because it's so sacramental to me too.
Sure. Yeah. And then, well, your Christian tradition as well. They eat the god in the Mass, in the Eucharist, interestingly, and become ideally transformed into the god, which is a different trajectory to go with. But okay, but that, yeah, non-dualism, I think that the problem of dualism really prevents us from understanding the later Platonists. Apart from the materialism that we live in, the dualism, it doesn't help us, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. And it does help you understand a lot of what was going on in antiquity. You referenced the Greek magical papyri in your book, and you see the same sort of things in a lot of those spells where someone is invoking multiple gods at the same time, and it's hard to distinguish what's going on. You've got Jewish gods, you've got Egyptian gods, you've got Greek gods, and they're all kind of combining into one persona, and they're also being personified by the magician himself. And it could be confusing, but when you look at it through this lens, it does make a lot more sense.
Yeah, and I don't know, was it in the chapter on mantras that I talked about the distinction between what the magicians are doing and what the theurgists are doing?
Yeah, I don't remember. I'd like to get into that for sure. It was somewhere around that area.
We can wait. If we can. I don't want to jump into anything that we can get there gradually.
Okay.
Okay.
If it makes sense, we could do it whenever it makes sense. Right. Mm-hmm. But as far as the non-dual idea, yeah, this idea of, I would like to maybe have you extrapolate on the gods, the nature of the gods themselves per Iamblichus, because oftentimes we look at the gods as from almost like a Hollywood or a Marvel Cinematic Universe perspective, where they are living in some far off place up on the mountain or up in the clouds, and they're totally separate from us and from everything else. And what you're saying, from what I understand and what Iamblichus is saying, is that's not the case. The gods are interpenetrating everything all the time.
Right.
Everywhere.
Right. Right. And some of the people that have helped me reimagine the gods in a more accessible way are people like James Hillman, the Jungian therapist and writer, who talks about the polytheism of the soul and the polytheistic soul and how the gods are present in all kinds of things that we do. And there's nothing wrong with having these images of the gods in their, you know, divine world and all that, you know, just sort of as a token. But it's when they're living in us, that's where it really matters. And that's where we really see it and feel it. And each one of us integrates these things, these attitudes and activities and tendencies in a different way. I think that Marsilio Ficino in the Renaissance was a masterful, how would I put it, astrologer and magician in a way, who tried to integrate the embodied soul to the planetary gods, who he saw manifested throughout nature and in us, so that the lion is the sun. It's not an image of that, but it is the sun in the animal form, or gold is the sun in a mineral form, and Venus is a certain flower in the flower realm, so on. That those presences in the world were symbols that were direct manifestations of these divine energies, and that by integrating them in rituals, we awaken their proper expression in ourselves. At least that's what I understood Ficino to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that's how the theurgist is able to connect with the gods? It's because the gods are already present in the theurgist. Would you say that's appropriate?
I would say that's appropriate. Yeah, it's just waking up to what's here, and allowing ourselves to be receptive to what's already here. But until we get to a state of receptivity, we can't bring it to life.
So it sounds like you're talking about a kind of radical immanence that's more dependent upon a purification of the organs of perception rather than a drawing down into matter. Because if even Hule is of divine origin, then it's inescapable. The conclusion is really inescapable that there is a sort of transcendental immanence.
Yes, I think so. But in order to receive it or to awaken it, might need to go through the detour of a feeling as if we're invoking it, as if it was someplace else. That's just, I think that might be a psychological trick that we need to go through in order to wake up what's already here.
And I just want to touch on Hillman for a minute. You know, I think a lot of people, I always find it remarkable when people criticize Jung or even someone like Hillman, because usually it demonstrates a pretty substantial lack of awareness of the material. But when you see Hillman or when you see Jung or von Franz talking about the archetypes in the psyche, Jung is actually very explicit that he is not simply saying that the archetypes only exist in the collective, in the psyche, but that the archetypes manifest within the psyche.
Right, right.
You know, he's just showing how the Platonic archetypes are present in. He's really showing what you're talking about, that they're present in the psyche, and because we all have a psyche, that we can experience them directly.
Exactly. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jung is much more than just a psychologist. He's also a theologian in a sense, even though he might not have wanted to admit it while he was alive, because he wanted to come across as a medical man. He was a prophetic man, really. He was a visionary. He was a guru, really. That's the reality of it. And the Red Book shows how totally strange he was willing to be in order to engage these elements of the psyche that were hidden to us.
And it is very reminiscent of, what you were saying is that we have to wake up what's already in us, reminiscent of Mahayana Buddhism, where the idea is everyone is a Buddha already. There's already a Buddha nature that's existent in us presently, and it's not something apart from us. We just have to kind of clean off the dirt and dust and sand and find that Buddha nature within us. And I was wondering, from the theurgic Hellenic perspective, what that purification may look like as far as finding that one which is in us, as Amblicus puts it.
What does a purification look like? Well, that's a good question. My first kind of answer is to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Iamblichus talks about catharsis, and he talks about when in order to achieve a catharsis, I would lean into the traditional understanding of the virtues and and finding the right kind of balance and not doing anything in excess and not doing anything not enough and finding it, you know, the right balance of the soul. But once that balance is achieved, Iamblica says, when you achieve the essence of, found your soul's essence through cleansing, which to my mind, I think of cleansing as a lot of what people associate with Plotinus as saying, letting go of this and letting go of that, which is also in Buddhism. But what you find is that there's some sort of essential something there. And then Iamblica says, once you've reached that, then you allow that to participate in the organizing of the universe, that it enters into the sort of the demiurgic unfolding of reality, so that you see yourself as not trying to get away from the mistakes and the dirt and things that you've been cleaning yourself from, but that you're investing this divine energy with the creativity that comes from something deep inside you. But in order to get to that, you do have to let go of the focuses that you've been, you know, putting your attention on that are not that. And so there is a cleansing first, and then there is an unfolding. It's a purification followed by the sort of the revelation, which is kind of similar to the pattern of the old Greek mysteries, the purification and then the revelation. And it's the same process, I think, ultimately. But it's not, catharsis can be misunderstood as just getting away from the world, and that's where it can lend towards a dualist kind of interpretation. And I think it was the French philosopher, Neoplatonist Trouillard, says that Plotinus goes to divinity by night. He excludes everything, you know, and everything is cut out. And by contrast, I think Iamblichus goes to divinity by day and includes everything. And you could say, well, the difference between them could just be superficial. Maybe Iamblichus first excludes and then he includes, but he puts more emphasis on the including, the embracing of all things. Yeah. So how, what are the purification rites? They're probably standard, you know, traditional philosophical practices of limiting, not giving in to certain emotional states and reflecting on what you did during the day, as the Pythagoreans were supposed to do. Where did I blow it? You know, how can I, you know, improve myself? Just those basic things. That's kind of a purification process.
Yeah. And while he may not have, Iamblichus may not have seen the body as, or the material as being evil, as Plotinus may have, it was still seen as a lower place with defilements that needed to be overcome. Not that, again, not that they were evil, but that there were traps and things that needed to be kind of resolved. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I would say that this is the place where the world soul works out its kinks through us. But I wouldn't say that it's kind of that it's a mistake for us to be in the body. In fact, the fact that we have all these kinks to work out is the intention of the world soul. I'm jumping way ahead of where you want to be on this.
No, you're good.
There's a passage. The Neoplatonists did a lot of interpreting of the Orphic tradition and talking about the god Dionysus and how Dionysus is torn apart by the Titans. And they understood that this tearing apart of Dionysus into multiplicity of parts was a metaphor for the manifestation of the world soul embracing the totality of things. So that this fragmenting of Dionysus's body, the dismemberment of Dionysus's body, is a way of talking about the procession of from the ineffable nothingness to reality, and it gets spread out over the world, including us. And one of the Neoplatonists named Olympiodorus says that Dionysus is the monad of the Titans, which is to say, in Pythagorean terms, he's the source of the Titans. And so what the Titans do, tearing apart the body of Dionysus, is the will of Dionysus as a kind of a demiurgic lord of this world. So yeah, we're down here, torn apart, tearing ourselves apart by our habits, doing our titanic thing of causing ourselves to get in all kinds of shitty situations in traffic, in relationships and everything else. but it's how we throw ourselves into the world. It's how we ensoul the world. And that includes our being confused and suffering. That there's a sense here, and I don't quite get it myself, personally or theoretically, how our suffering and our confusion is actually part of what we're supposed to be doing. And there's a part of us that if we could just embrace it the right way, that we don't need to get rid of it. We just need to enter into it from a deeper perspective. So that's kind of what I'm just starting to sort of get a feel for that. But I wish I could do it on a personal level too, which I can't.
I hear you. I mean, I think man has been struggling with that for how many thousands and thousands of years?
Yeah, it's a situation we're in.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that you brought up the Orphics and Dionysus, because our last episode was actually focused on that, so that fits right in. And I feel like it might be a good transition into the idea that you present in your book on the Bomiskos, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, the Bomiskos, yes, yes. That's the altar-shaped. Iamblichus says that the Pythagoreans believe that numbers have shapes. And also the physical body has a spherical number, 6 × 6 × 6, which is spherical. And the physical body is a Bomiskos, which is shaped kind of like a rectangle. But it's also the same shape as the altar in the Greek world, the sacrificial altar. And that just seemed to be too much of a coincidence to me, that the number or the shape of the altar is the same as the shape of the human body. So that the human body is, in a sense, the sacrificial altar on which the god sacrifices its divinity into mortality. That we're the altar on which the god sacrifices himself into this world. And yet at the same time, upon our altars, we make sacrifices to the god to return to the god. So there's a kind of a both and that's going on with coming down into this world by assuming the altar-shaped body, and also going back to the divine world by offering up sacrifices to the gods and re-entering the sphere. And it's not like the sphere and the altar are separated, but it's only by, and this is where I think a lot of us get tripped up in the dualism piece. It's not like you're going to get somewhere and not have to be here, but it's actually entering into the activity that comes from there, which is always coming here. And then once we're here and we find, oh, this is shitty, then we say, no, I want to get somewhere else. But there's no somewhere else. There's an activity that comes from the source that's always coming out here and re-embracing the mess that we're in. But I think the trick is to find the way of re-entering into that activity. And that's why I like Iamblichus' focus on theurgy, which is divine action. That's what theurgy is. It's coming from the divine into this world, manifesting the divinity in this world. The sacrificial altar is our body. Our bodies are the altar upon which the god sacrifices its divinity into the mortal state. And that's another way to look at who we are. I'm a god being sacrificed into mortality. And that's why I have this altar-shaped body. And that would be a different way to sort of imagine who we are, as opposed to just saying, oh, trouble. No, it's something I've come down from above, somewhere else, or from some interior place. The body is the altar on which the sacrifice is made. I thought it was a cool idea. It may be proven to be completely misguided, but it may be one of those cool, misguided ideas that might spark somebody else to have another insight. At least that was my thought.
I think it's cool.
Good. Glad to hear it.
And it does. It does kind of have. It did remind me of a little bit of Christianity there, with the God sacrificing himself to come down into a mortal body. I don't know that was your intention to kind of make that connection, but
not necessarily. But you know, I have to say that there are parts of Christianity with its emphasis on the God becoming mortal that. In a way, that's a very theurgic idea. Mm-hmm. And the wounds of Christ It's a very theurgic idea that by we enter into the divine state through the wounds of Christ, as you know, a pious Catholic would do. That's a very theurgic idea, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The only shift I would make is that the Platonists and Iamblichus allow that it's any soul that can manifest this divine connection. And it's not always put on somebody else, namely Jesus as the only one. And then that's swallowed up by the institutional structures of the church and the hegemony and all the rest of it. And then it becomes something other than what I think it was meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you kind of covered it. And I was going to ask if you thought it was problematic that we are use terms like ascent and descent as if there is a geographical separation again, like we've been discussing, but you did cover it. Maybe it's more interior, you know, it's not always coming from somewhere else and going somewhere else. I think that could trip people up, that language, but I guess it's useful.
It does trip people up. Yeah. It's just tripped me up. It's tripped us all up. It's tripped scholarship up. Mm-hmm. And it's not going up somewhere or coming down, but it's just a metaphor for, you could say, coming from inside outside or whatever you want to call it. But the metaphor taken literally can mislead us. That whole, I kind of, that Bomiskos piece was one of my most speculative exercises.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like you know, thinking about it and wondering about it. But go ahead, Dominic.
So as far as getting to the destination that is the goal of theurgy, what do you think are some important elements? I'll bring up an example that I've found to be important and interesting and relevant to the practice that I'm involved in is aesthetics. The use of, and maybe in theurgy, it's the use of symbols and tokens, but the use of aesthetics to change your mindset is important in the tradition I'm involved in, as far as, you know, maybe it's not actually important, but it does get your mind in a different place. For instance, the difference between like an old Catholic church or an old Buddhist church that's dimly lit with candles and there's icons and statues kind of in the shadows, and it creates a certain feeling that's evocative and gets you in a certain mood, as opposed to walking into maybe a modern Protestant church that's lit with like fluorescent lights and it's modern architecture and maybe the only decoration is just a simple crucifix or something like that. Do you see that as being an important aspect of the theurgic process as well?
Definitely. I feel it when you described it. Mm. In theurgy, we need to go outside in order to awaken what's inside. And if what's outside isn't resonant and doesn't have a real correlation to what's inside, it won't wake us up. That's why certain kinds of music and certain kinds of images have that kind of power. Even the cover of this book is kind of, it's a sort of an iconic sort of, has a kind of an iconic power, at least for me. It sort of puts me in a sort of a receptive mood, which is the necessary kind of mindset in order to be opened up to these deeper impulses and archetypes in us, gods, goddesses. And so, you're absolutely right. The aesthetic is essential. In fact, I've even argued that the theurgist, his or her path towards deification is through aesthesis, through the seeing and hearing, which are transformed ultimately into the ways in which the divine is revealed, both audibly and visually. And that's the tantric guys talk about that a lot too. But so what do you do with this exercise with aesthetics? Are there specific exercises you do, or how does it happen for you in your tradition?
I think it's just the general environment. It's set up and created so that it creates a separation from maybe your mundane. You're stepping into another mindset, into a different worldview, and it's getting you prepared to perhaps more efficiently and effectively go through those purification processes in order to get where you need to go, according to the tradition.
Yeah.
So it just gets you in the mood, I guess you could say.
Well, and I think it's really important that it does that. Yeah.
And I was going to say that I think that what we're really talking about here is less aesthetics and more the role that the aesthetic elements play in shifting our consciousness towards interiority. Because if we have an organized aesthetic environment, then that environment becomes sort of a mirror of the numinous, of the numina. You know, if the environment is filled with divine images, colors, flowers, scents, and they're all attuned to the key, to the tone, then they become sort of receptive transmitters of the series.
Receptive transmitters of sin.
Of the series,
that is to say, the energies that are descending from the one. Is that what you mean? Or I didn't.
That's exactly what
yeah,
I mean. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. I just wasn't sure that's what you were referring to. Yeah. So the use of the aesthetic environment is precisely to mirror and to evoke the presence of this divine element that we're trying to awaken in ourselves, that we carry this in us, but unless it can be triggered from something outside us, it doesn't get stirred up and awakened. So the environment and the materials, things that we engage are really important in this kind of tradition. And maybe at some point we don't need them so much, but I think most of us need them a great deal. And I know that I do. I mean, the environment is really important. And that would probably even include, if you want to get down to it, even the kind of the people that we hang out with. Mm. That certain people and the way that they move and things like that tend to awaken us more than other people. And I know that sounds like, I didn't think I would say that, but that might lead one to be more discriminating about what kind of people you hang out with. And maybe that's appropriate.
I think so.
Well, it's interesting to me that you mentioned that, because in the, you know, in the esoteric tradition, at least in the West, the idea is that different souls are part of different choirs or groups. And so we would naturally be attracted to the souls that we have an affinity for, that maybe even originate in the same divine line as us, and maybe have antipathy for those souls that might be from a less compatible line. And so I think that, you know, if you tend to be of a Venusian character, you might be attracted to Venusian people. If you're rooted in the Venusian hierarchy, then it's likely you're going to be attracted to people who express those traits.
I think you're right. And I know that the Neoplatonists imagined themselves in that way. I believe that Proclus saw himself in the Hermetic line, the god Hermes, I believe Proclus did. And Nicomachus, he thought he was a reincarnation of Nicomachus, the mathematician. But yeah, they did see affinities with one another based on their connection to what they sometimes would call their leader god, their root god. And I haven't really thought about that a whole lot for myself. I mean, I can look at my astrological chart and I can see what planets are empowered or in positions of power and which are not. And I think there's something to that. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that a whole lot. Are you guys into astrology? Is that part of the discipline that you think about or play with?
To a degree, from myself,
I feel like a baby with it. You know, it's such an immersive, deep science that Someday I intend to fully devote myself to the study of it. I have a good working knowledge, but I can't say I'm an expert. However, I notice correlations between events in the external realm and movements among the stars. But I think that astrology is useful as more of a model of the psychocosmos, even more than the physical cosmos. I think astrology is very archetypal, and also when you align your theurgy, I think with that, it can be really useful. I think today, because of the materialism of Western culture, we tend to maybe view astrology as being, you know, dependent upon the material planets. But I think that the material planets are just material representations of archetypal forces, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, and that kind of raises the question. The big question is, what's going on with most of this stuff? And say, for example, if we were living in the midst of a jungle and we never even saw the stars at night, our cosmos would probably be more described by certain kinds of trees and animals that we're surrounded by. And we would find archetypal energies represented by them instead of by something that we never see, which are the stars and the planets, which is what the Greeks and the Egyptians would see. So I think that I don't take them literally either, Janice. It is more of a psychodynamic put into poetic expression, and that somehow it seems to be a way for us to communicate about parts of ourselves that we ordinarily are not conscious of. And it even, for me, sometimes raises the question of, why are people even interested in theurgy and Platonism and these deep ideas? Is it just some sort of escapist thing that we do because we don't know how to engage with how miserable and boring the world would be without some sort of escape? Mm. And I question myself from time to time, what am I doing being involved in this? And I'm not sure, but I noticed that I guess I trust that when I am energized and awakened and feel more full of life because of what I'm doing and working on this material, I decide to trust it. Do I take everything that I've written or everything I've considered literally? No, I don't. But I trust the process. But I kind of have to ask myself the big question from time to time. Is this all, are we all just bullshitting ourselves? Or you know, what's real here? And I can only go by what I experience to decide if it's real or not, if it's real for me. And that doesn't mean it's going to be real for somebody else. And that's why when somebody says, well, I'm just not interested in that, or I just don't feel it, I respect that. And they have a different path. And that's great.
There's a couple of things that come to mind when you say that to me. For me, the first one is something I've been wanting to mention for a bit in this conversation, and that's that in one of our other discussions on theurgy with a friend of ours that comes on here sometimes, Nicholas Schreck, you know, we were talking about folk tantra in India, you know, like a folk Shaktism, for instance. Mm-hmm. And in that, in the simple pouring of a water libation by someone living in a village in rural India, you know, that simple, the simple actions in an act of folk tantra are still mirrors of the cosmic reality and represent in their simplicity a true manifestation of the highest, a manifestation of the highest truth in their utter simplicity. And I think that the challenge for those who are intellectually or philosophically inclined is to get outside of the desire to interpret and analyze and into the immediacy of the moment and the primal experience that is right there, right in front of us. Mm-hmm. You know, that is constantly there, like you were talking about at the beginning of the conversation.
Well, right. It's already there. And that kind of leads me to want to go to what Dominic had said, that he had read through, I believe, the chapter on mantras, and something that Iamblichus says about the divine names that theurgists will repeat, that are, he calls them the asema anomata. Asema meaning the meaningless names, anomata. What's the point of chanting meaningless names? And Porphyry had said, well, you know, what do they mean? Tell us what they mean, because you could, you know, if we don't know what they mean, what's the point? And Iamblichus says, the point is that we don't know what they mean. And it's too subtle to be explained conceptually. And there's a part of us, I think, that hungers for some sort of pre-conceptual or non-conceptual reality that we gain access to through the chanting of sounds or mantras, mantras in tantra, these asema anomata in theurgy. And that's just part of our mystery of who we are as human beings. I think that because I'm an intellectual, and that's my habit, is to be rational and intellectual, we have to recognize that there's some things that just can't quite be felt deeply through an intellectual approach. Mm. They have to be felt more deeply in the body, and sometimes only through chanting something that takes you out of your head and just allows you to feel as if you're just a vehicle for some sound that's more than you, but that it's the real you. Those kinds of experiences, I think, are that we hunger for. And why do they make us feel so energized and good and full? I don't know, but they do. I think that's why people like sometimes going to church and singing in choirs, and why people like to go to puja and chant, that we long to get into some kind of energetic flow that's deeper than our thinking. And I think that's what mantras do. And I think that's what these divine names do.
It's like agnosia as a way to gnosis. Like lack of, you know, it's a sort of like the negative knowledge, like entering into the almost like the holy fool that you see in among many mystics, where they travel this path, but they eventually become they become so apparently simple, and yet they're in this ecstatic union with God, and they're like for instance, who's the Buddhist? There's a Buddhist sage who was a Zen master, and he was a total fool.
Ryokan, maybe?
Or was it Ryokan or Basho or something? He kept talking about the marvelously unborn Buddha mind, and he was constantly playing tricks and acting like an idiot, but he was recognized as enlightened.
I want to go back to this idea, if I could, Dom, yeah. If it's consistent with where you're at. Is this notion of the meaning of these mantras and names?
Yeah.
I think you said you wrestled with that yourself sometimes.
Yeah.
Porphyry had been asking Iamblichus, what does it mean? What do these names mean? And the way I put it was that Porphyry's interest in the meaning of the names misses the point entirely. He's more interested in our concepts and in our explanations about the gods than in experiencing them and embodying them. And so the way Iamblichus discussed this was that he says, it's necessary, and I'm just reading you Iamblichus here, but I think it's a good piece.
Yeah.
It's necessary to remove all concepts and logical deductions from divine names. It's the symbolic character of divine resemblance, which is spiritual and divine, that must be assumed in these names. And indeed, although it is unknowable to us, this very fact is its most sacred aspect. It's too exalted to be divided into knowledge.
It's so wonderful. And, yeah.
Yeah. But knowing is always, I know this, I know. It transcends that knowing exercise. There's something in us that's deeper than that what we can think and know. And that's why I think they emphasize that the way that we connect with the highest is not by our thinking, but by our eros, by our desiring, by our longing.
Yes.
And
yes.
And these chants, these mantras and divine names are ways of firing up that longing that allows us to connect. Mm-hmm. It's too exalted to be divided into knowing. I love that phrase.
You know what it also makes me think of is like, have you ever had a dream where you heard notes or music that couldn't be that you couldn't remember while awake? Or have you ever seen colors in a dream that you can't see in the material realm? I've had experiences in my life where I've heard in dream states of consciousness, I've heard music with sounds that I couldn't properly remember when I awoke because the sounds were outside of my body's ability. Like they were beyond my hearing. They were notes I could not hear in the physical body. Mm. And I think that these onomata, mm-hmm, that I think that they also contain sound beyond sound.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a nice connection. Yeah, I hadn't quite thought about it like that, connecting it to the sounds you hear in dreams that you can't hear or reproduce in daytime, but that they penetrate to that kind of level. That's what I hear you suggesting. You know, I think it's important. How would I put this? I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book is that I really think that our understanding of the later Platonic tradition needs to appreciate the embodied aspect of their spirituality more than we have. And that's to get away from the dualism that Dom, mm-hmm, you were asking about at the very beginning, that these people like Iamblichus and Proclus and Pythagoras and Socrates too, they were very charismatic and magnetic individuals whose presence made a difference when they walked into the room. There was something about them. And we have lost that in our Western intellectual traditions. People don't go to hear a philosopher for darshan. You know, you don't walk into the room and somebody's giving a lecture on a topic, in a philosophy teacher, and you feel as if you've been completely stoned out of your mind because you're in the presence of that person. You don't, because they stay in their heads, and it's been swallowed up by this intellectualizing and conceptualizing. And that's because it lacks this connection to the energetic body. I guess I would call it the subtle body, or the okema, the pneuma, the etheric body that's been vitalized in these traditional Platonic thinkers, philosophers. They embodied a kind of, otherworldly presence. And just to be in their presence gave you access to something deeper than what you normally lived with. And talking about hanging out with certain kinds of people, that's why people wanted to hang out with these kind of individuals, because they would just take it in by osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's charisma, charis being grace.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't have that today, not in our universities, colleges. And here's the problem I see sometimes, is that among people who are not in the academic world, who are interested in deep spiritual things and really penetrate into them and get in touch with them, there is a kind of lack of, how would I put it, discipline or a setting of boundaries, so that people kind of know where they begin and know where they end. There is a kind of sometimes a tendency towards a sort of megalomania and egocentric kind of a sense of where this takes us. Because if I'm not like one of those academics, I'm some heavy, deep kind of guru guy, and I'm a more than other people. And that's the problem that we people in non-academic pursuits can fall prey to. I mean, To their credit, the academics are really uptight, and they have rigorous, you know, sort of double checking everybody's every word. Mm-hmm. And outside of the academic world, we don't have that. So you can get anybody up there, put on a white robe, and he can just start bullshitting. And people think, oh, wow, you know, especially if he does it with a kind of a hypnotic voice or some kind of, you know, affect. that makes people think, oh, he's got his shit together. Wow. No, he doesn't. He's just full of shit. And he doesn't know it. And unless we're able to see that, unless we're able to question our own understanding and our own importance and our own insight, then we'll go off the rails. And that's why when I brought up earlier, are we all just bullshitting ourselves? What are we doing with this? Mm-hmm. We need to be humble enough to ask that question. You know, yeah. Maybe we don't know a effing thing.
Right.
And we're just fooling ourselves. But I don't think we're fooling ourselves, but we have to remember to ask the question just to stay honest and to not get inflated. It's really easy to get inflated with this stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
It's inevitable to get inflated.
You're really speaking my language here. I can relate so much to what you're talking about. In the past, this is directly, again, connecting to a conversation I just had yesterday with a friend about this. I think that it's so important to be able to get outside of that intellectuality, the cerebrality. Yep. And this is also connecting to something. It becomes difficult because in our translations of this Platonic material, this Neoplatonic material, we see a tendency to call things intellectual they translate things as intellectual. And because we've attributed the word intellectual to our analytical, rational, cerebral function, the idea of intellective, the idea of the noetic is lost a lot of the time because of this translation. You know, like when the Platonic philosophers are talking about the intellect, they're not really talking a lot of the time about our brain.
Right.
They're talking about nous.
Look, you know, the point you're making is a really, really important one. And it's kind of hard to describe it clearly, but you know it when you see it and feel it, that there are certain that it is connected to our ability to be rational. The noetic can come across, can manifest itself, can communicate itself in words and in language and in insights. But it's not in the specific words, it's in the way the words are used. So there has to be a spirit that moves them, and that spirit is what's noetic. It's not in the explicit argumentation that you might put down on a piece of paper, but it's in the spirit that moves it that the noetic presence is felt. That's why sometimes you feel it more when you're in the presence of somebody who's actually talking. Every now and again, you can feel it when you read what somebody has written, but it's in the spirit that moves it rather than in this explicit argumentation of it, I think.
And even more so the experience of and the participation in the ideas, in the activity. I think you mentioned in your book, it's a quote from Iamblichus where he says, you know, why not verbatim, obviously. Why are not all philosophers essentially enlightened? There's a difference between the experiential mm-hmm. and the participatory, and maybe just like mm-hmm. the book learning and the intellectual. If philosophy is this great enlightening thing, why are all philosophers not enlightened? Well, there's a separation there.
And that comes from perhaps one of the most well-known quotations from Iamblichus that mm-hmm. That it's not a matter of philosophical learning. Otherwise, what would prevent philosophers from having this connection right. with the gods? But rather, the symbols themselves do the work. It's not us; it's the symbols themselves that we encounter in the ritual that have the power, not us. And it subordinates our thinking to something more than our thinking. And that scandalized people like E.R. Dobbs, who thought, well, he's just introduced mumbo jumbo into the great Platonic tradition. But no, he's recognizing the limits of the conceptual mind, and that's something deeper than a conceptual mind. And he's making that explicit. That's what I see. Here it is. I found the quote. If I read a little bit of it.
Definitely.
Intellectual understanding doesn't connect the ear just with the gods. Rather, it's the perfect accomplishment of ineffable acts, things that we don't understand, religiously performed, you know, doing it with the right intention, beyond our understanding. And it's the power of symbols understood by the gods alone that affects theurgical union. For although we don't understand it, the symbols themselves on their own perform their work, and the ineffable power of the gods to whom these symbols belong recognizes by itself its own images, and it is not awakened to this by our thinking. So it's really taking the authority away from us. It's taking the control away from us, and it's inviting us to be receptacles and servants of something greater than us by performing these rites. That's what theurgy is. And yet, even though it takes away our agency, it's the only way that we really awaken to our deeper agency, where we can become really connected to what's divine and creative and powerful, which is a paradox. Only by becoming non-agential, by being totally passive towards this greater than us, that's the only way that we become truly active.
And that's the difficulty. Like we had said earlier, and this relates to the mantra conversation. You know, I've been struggling with mantra for years, just trying to figure out what are the mechanics, why does it work? Very porphyry in that way. But eventually you learn that it's more of a gateway to this. The mantra are not rational, but they are a door to this different mindset of ineffability, of just letting go and experiencing. And in that way, that they're extremely valuable because they are that entrance point, you know?
Yeah. Portals. And maybe we aren't all that important.
Yeah.
Maybe the mantras are more important than we are, you know? in a sense, that's what he's saying. Mm. That it's hard to imagine that I'm not that important though. You know?
Well, something I think too is that in the post-Enlightenment rationalist thought created this heavy emphasis on the value of analysis. I mean, and in Western esotericism we see this too, especially in Victorian Western esotericism, a little bit later, where there's this emphasis on the will and the effort. And even today we see that in, you know, you're supposed to visualize these things and do all these things, when in reality, if you go further back into the magical and esoteric traditions, it really had very little to do with willing, very little to do with visualizing. It was more, as you've said, about, as Iamblichus says, about performing the rites correctly, about really becoming a participant in a process rather than seeing yourself as the locus of power. And ultimately, that's, I think, somewhat egoistic. I just listened to a really interesting lecture on the notion of the daimon in Plotinus. And it was speaking about how you can read Plato as in reference to the daimon, and Plotinus as simultaneously saying the daimon is outside of the self and within, or outside of the soul and within the soul. But the reconciliation of those positions is that the soul, the daimon is reflected within the soul. And how can the daimon be reflected within the soul without the soul becoming simple and calm? Like I liken it to like water. When a pool of water becomes still and calm, it turns into a mirror. And I think that that's the value of these things, is we become still and we become calm and reflective. And then within us, within the mirror of our soul, is reflected the divinity, which is manifest in the daimon.
Nice. Sounds like it was a good lecture that you heard. You know, it was making me think, as you were talking about that the difference between being the simplicity of just performing religious rituals, say the pious Catholic woman who just goes in and she performs her ritual. She does the rosary and she just does it. And then she goes out and goes home, and she's not thinking about, oh, You know, did I get closer to God? But she just does it. And there's not a lot of egotistical sort of measuring about how well did I do. They just do it. And yet we're so damn hungry to understand, and I am too, that the Platonists, what I like about them is that they're able to engage that insatiable intellectual hunger that we all have and deal with it in subtle and sophisticated ways and try as well as they can to bring it back to a pious engagement with the divine that's as simple as that little old woman who does the rosary in the church. But how do you get these crazy, intellectually hungry, titanically hungry human beings that we are and allow them to enter into that kind of quiet, you know, receptivity? Somehow, I think that's what I see Iamblichus trying to do with theurgy and emphasizing how it's a state of receptivity that's important. And not our knowing, not our understanding, and not explaining what does the mantra mean. It's not about what it means. It's the fact is that we don't know what it means. And the fact is that we just do it. That's the importance. And how an intellectual who wants to understand and control everything can accept that, that's the real challenge. I think you need somebody with a lot of charisma, we were talking about earlier, who's able to make that seem convincing.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I love how you put that. And it kind of leads me into the idea of the theurgist versus, not in an adversarial way, but as opposed to the goes or the sorcerer. I was wondering if you can maybe speak to that, the differentiation there.
Oh, I had a fun time trying to distinguish those two.
Yeah.
There's a really, I want to make sure I remember his name, and right now it's not coming to mind, but I know it's right in this chapter. Edmonds, Radcliffe Edmonds III. He wrote a really good book on called Drawing Down the Moon, Magic in the Ancient Greco-Roman World.
Yes.
And he has a chapter in there where he compares the magician to the theurgist, and he says, essentially, these magicians were theurgists, and they were doing what Iamblichus says, and they were even using Iamblichus's arguments to defend the compelling of the gods to come down and do what they want. And there's a lot of legitimacy to what he says, and I think he's a good scholar and he does good work. But the difference, I think, between the goes and the theurgist is this. For the theurgist, it always has to come to us from outside, and we make ourselves receptive to the god. And we take on the shape of the god through performing the ritual. We're humans, but through the ritual, we take on the shape of the god. The magician, on the other hand, learns the names of the gods and invokes them and so on. But it's almost as if the magician has the gods take on his shape. In other words, what happens is that instead of his ego being made transparent, like the theurgist ego becomes transparent to the gods, it's that he absorbs the gods into his own ego and he becomes a monstrous caricature of what the theurgist should be. He becomes a kind of, I am the god, and these beings will obey me and do this. When Iamblichus is asked to perform a miracle early on in Eunapius' story about invoking these spirits of the ponds that he's near, he says, it's not up to me. I just need to wait for the right time. And I just need to wait. In other words, I need to enter into a state of receptivity before I can actually touch the water and make the spirit manifest. In other words, I'm not in control. The gods are in control. Whereas the magician, the goe, seems to be, I'm in control. And I think it's inevitable. Proclus writes about how Alcibiades manifests the same sort of mentality that the magician does, that he wants his name to be expanded across the whole world, that I'm the most important guy, I'm Alcibiades, and, you know, pay attention to me. It's sort of the mindset of you know, every politician or every king, whatever it is, everybody should know who I am. Proclus says that's a completely natural impulse that we've got. because the names of the gods penetrate the entire universe and they create the world. These resonant names of the gods, like these mantras that permeate everything. And so naturally, since they're in us, we think that it has to do with us. So we want my name to penetrate the whole world, not realizing that it's not about me, it's about something prior to me that has to resonate throughout the world. So Alcibiades wants everybody to know his name, but it's actually not his name that's important. It's the presence of these divine names that penetrate Alcibiades and everything else that's important. And the only way you get to that is going through what I would describe as what Socrates provides for the Platonists, that elenchos, that sort of questioning of who you are. And in a way that we were doing before, is everything we're doing just bullshit? Who am I really doing this? Am I just writing this book in order to kind of like pump up my ego and to become important and have these guys interview me and make me think, hey, I'm such a hot shit, you know? And am I doing it for that reason? Yes, I am. And to be able to recognize that and say, okay, that's not what it's about. But recognize that impulse is still there in me because it's natural for it to be in me and natural for it to be in you. And Proclus says, that's okay because it's been seeded into us, but we have to learn how to get past it. We have to learn how to see through it and learn how to do things that don't make everything collapse into my ego. And so I think the magician represents somebody who wants to collapse all of these magical and wonderful things that he's doing into his ego. And that ultimately, Iamblichus says, that's self-destructive. And the theurgist is somebody who has found a way. And I like to think of Socrates as representing that kind of Socratic purification of the soul through questioning us and asking ourselves, what is our motivation here? Do I really know what I'm doing? And why am I doing it? And all of that stuff. And it's humiliating to go through that, because you end up into a state of aporia, as Socrates would describe it, not knowing what way to go. And that is the necessary state that you have to be in order to be able to do these things without being self-aggrandizing, like the magician is. The goes doesn't go through that aporia. He doesn't get translated into nothingness before he does his spell. It's all about how important he is. Whereas the theurgist, it's close to the nothingness. And Iamblichus talks about it's our udania, our nothingness, that allows us to connect with the gods, not our importance. That's the difference for me between the goes and the theurgist. Even though they may do the same kinds of things, one is self-aggrandizing and the other one is not.
Well, here's my question. And you said self-destructive.
I overtalked that. Go ahead.
No, you didn't at all. So if the goes is, let's say, hypothetically, the goes is equally as effective in their work as the theurgist, if they're able to make the same things happen, the same results, let's say, then what is the downside? What really are there consequences to the behaviors and the paradigm of the goes? Does that make
sense? That's a great question. And okay, from two angles I'd like to approach that from. One is that I think that we're all goes until we become theurgists. Mm. Because, you know, to the degree that we've been cleansed and purified and trained, we tend to be self-aggrandizing. I think that's just, might as well be humble enough to admit it. But what's the difference between somebody who's a goes and somebody who's a theurgist? Iamblichus tells us that the goes doing these things, that eventually it destroys him. How does it destroy him? I don't know. And I suppose that if I had more experience to draw from here with individuals who seem to have a lot of charisma, but also seem to be sort of megalomaniacs and sort of inflated, what happens to the circle of people around such individuals? And my guess is that probably a lot of damage happens. But I can't say that from experience because I haven't been around people like that much lately.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, I would tend to think I use karma as a way to understand these differences because
yeah.
You know, if you're going to be cutting corners with your morality and your ethics, then for me, I believe there are going to be consequences for that. And so that could be what leads to the self-destruction because, you know, you got on a certain path where you are maybe you aren't using the best judgment as far as morals and ethics, and you are hurting people. You're taking what's not yours, that sort of stuff. It comes back to you eventually. And so in my mind, that could be the difference. But could there be goas that are moral and ethical? I mean, I guess there could be.
I think by the sheer fact that the goas hasn't gone through that state of aporia, mm-hmm. of not knowing, that he or she would lack the humility that's necessary in order to really, I don't know, to be in the presence of somebody who doesn't have that kind of understanding of their own nothingness.
Yeah.
That it's almost a sense that it's oppressive almost to be in the presence of somebody like that. That you always have to feel as if you have to adhere to what they're saying or thinking or doing. That you can't relax in the presence of somebody like that. And I think in that sense, they might be very efficient and effective. And there's probably a lot of CEOs and business leaders who are really effective kind of magicians, you know, and do a lot of things, but it's self-aggrandizing. And they use imagery all the time in order to cast spells on people.
Sure, yeah.
And to influence and control. And governments do it. And that's what propaganda is too. I mean, we're surrounded by a culture of goetia and goes. And people really aren't encouraged to not know, you know, to enter into that state of humility and aporia that Socrates would put people into. And that's why they killed him. It was just too difficult to deal with a dude like that. I think that's part of it. But I think the whole question of the role of the goes and the difference between the goes and the theurgist is one that it's going to be explored even more. I think this guy Radcliffe Edmonds is a really good scholar and he's worth paying attention to in that area.
Cool. Thanks for following me down that rabbit hole.
No, that's a good one. I it's one that really appeals to me too.
Yeah. I want to be mindful of the time. Are you still good for a little bit, or would you be willing to discuss one more? I did want to talk about the idea of light before, that before we wrapped up. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Once again, photagogia.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a really cool name and a cool idea. So first I want to mention that there's a book by a woman named Junko Teresa Mikuria, Mikuria. And she wrote a book called A History of Light, The Idea of Photography. And, you know, curious title for a book. And in that book, you know, she's a photographer by trade, but she dove into all of the Neoplatonic stuff that has to do with light and theurgy. And I learned from reading her, and she said basically all of theurgy is photagogia. I have a hard time with it too sometimes. And agogia is to lead. Like, and photo has to do with light. So it's leading the light, drawing in the light. And Iamblichus essentially argues that most rituals of divination and chanting and everything else is a way of attracting divine light because the divinity is imagined as light. And so if you're doing these practices that bring you closer to the divine, you're bringing light into your subtle body, your imagination, your okema, and you're filling up your energetic body with the presence of divine light through performing chanting. And that's leading in the light, photagogia, performing these rituals. It's all of theurgy is photagogia, essentially. And this Teresa Mukherjee, she just nailed it with that. And then the subtle body, the okema, gets filled with light and it becomes algoides. It becomes a shining form, and it becomes spherical, at which point you've entered into, and you were talking earlier, Janice, about the noetic. You've entered into the noetic place and you're filled with light through the process of this leading the light in, this photagogia. But you do it through chanting and seeing images of the gods or daimons or angels and a variety of other kind of astral beings. All of theurgy is leading in the light, I would say. And you know what's interesting, and I don't know, you guys haven't mentioned any of this either, but in the chapter I did on the subtle body, I leaned a lot on the work of somebody named Simon Cox, who wrote a really good book on the genealogy of the subtle body. Hmm. And he included, after talking about the Neoplatonists and the Theosophists and other people like that, and by the way, Simon Cox has spent 6 years in a Taoist monastery in China, so he did a lot of work himself with the subtle body. He introduces Carl Jung and Aleister Crowley as two individuals who emphasize working with the subtle body and the so-called light body, the golden flower, the diamond body that Jung talks about, and Crowley talks about the body of light. So they did practices of photagogia to fill their body up with light and enter into that light body. And, you know, when I was a spiritual seeker, I always thought of Aleister Crowley as like the embodiment of the devil, you know, the Beast 666 and scary dude. But the guy was quite insightful. He's not a choir boy by any means. No. But he had a lot of insight about working with the body of light. So those are some of the things that occur to me. And maybe you had something more specific in mind about photagogia.
I just thought it was interesting, the connections to the Chaldean oracles. And then you see it also in the Mithras liturgy in the
right.
Greek magical papyri. It's definitely a theme that runs through these different traditions. And so something there.
Well, and I would also say in the metaphysics of Gnosticism, light is absolutely primary. Mm. The photagogia is fundamental to the Gnostic metaphysics that you see in all schools, including the Manichaean school. In the Manichaean school of Gnosticism, it's very, very light focused. And I think that this is talking about the nous, the noetic light, the pneumatic light, which comes in the epiphania of the deity, you know, when the theurgic rites are completed and they are enacted successfully, then there should be a manifestation, an epoptia, an epiphania, and that epiphania usually comes through photagogia. It comes through the pneumatic light appearing to the eye of nous. Perhaps there are also correlating sympathetic material manifestations, but in my personal experience, which is very limited, that those things are secondary manifestations to the interior interior unveiling that occurs.
I'm not sure. But that you could be well be. But I think there is evidence in the magical papyri, and also the Gnostic material about the importance of light, certainly in the theurgical material and also in the tantric material. Light is seen as the manifestation of the divine, which I thought was interesting and compelling. And there's somebody, Paul Muller Ortega, who's a tantric scholar. He says that he talks about Abhinavagupta, a tantric teacher. And he says that talking about these experiences of light, he says his goal was the tricky task of attempting to be faithful to the fluid and subtly shifting clarities of yogic perceptions and experiences. And here's the experiential, relating them to, but never attempting to straitjacket them in the categories of technical philosophy. So these guys are philosophers, and yet they know there's something more fluid and a little bit more elusive than their conceptual language can capture. And the experience of light is precisely that. And so you've got the light, you've got it being erotic, you've got it, you know.
It's also symbolic.
Yeah, right, right. It's all to take us into some deeper place than where we normally are, which is our conceptual prison. How does it, Blake talks about it, is the mind manacles that we carry around with us. William Blake was fantastic about liberating us from our conceptual prisons.
He was very tantric.
Very much so. I believe you're right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's something that's interesting to me is that you're mentioning Abhinavagupta, and you know, you just spoke of these different elements, sound, light, eros, mm-hmm. Which extends from the cosmic to the personal. And in the tantric tradition, we see these things recapitulated in the figure of Devi, of Kali. In the Shaktism, Kali is said in her true essence to be pure light, pure consciousness, and pure sound.
Cool. No, that's interesting. Pure light, pure consciousness, pure sound. Again, we get the same elements wrapped up and then associated with this iconic figure, Kali or Shakti, Ma, or, you know, Hecate or Rhea, or depending on what tradition we're drawing from. Very interesting. So this notion of photogogia is a critical one for theurgy, and also in Tantra as well. This leading in the light, leading of the light, filling the soul up with light. The subtle body becomes a sphere filled with light, shining body, aogoides.
That's so interesting to me. In Shingon Buddhism, light is front and center. I mean, we have the light mantra. We have Dainichi Nyorai or Mahavira Chanabuddha, who's associated with light. And a lot of the practices, the visualizations, I might cut this out of the recording, but one of the practices, which is pretty important.
Yeah. Well, and what you just described with this ritual that you perform with the visualization of the moon there becomes a synthema that translates you mm-hmm. into an identification with the totality of the world soul, so that you become, at that moment, in the midst of the ritual, you take on the shape of the gods. You know, which is what Iamblichus says happens in every theurgic ritual. You're many human being, Dominic, you're doing this thing, but through the act of and the symbols themselves, you take on the shape of the gods, which is, I think, it's a mm-hmm. precise description of what you just said. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Iamblichean theurgy is worth bringing to light for our culture. And I also was thinking of the little old lady in the Catholic church in the pews doing the rosary. She's translating herself into spreading the compassion of Mother Mary to the extent of the whole universe. And she's going there too, to the similar place that you're going. But it's wonderful that people still have rituals that we can do like that. And the loss of, I don't want to sound like I'm an old time religion kind of guy, but the loss of religious practices, yeah. I think is devastating to a culture, because there's nothing, it's a loss of our humility as creatures that somehow we think that we're in control, that we control everything, that we decide, you know, everything that has to do with nature when we're just part of it. And I think religion and religious rituals help us to remind us that there's something greater than us. And we're invited to participate in that, like your moon ritual. I could feel you're filling up the whole universe if you can believe that, as you said. I did believe it. I could feel it as you were describing it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something that your first book did for me, interestingly, is in your discussions of Iamblichus's treatment of matter. Mm-hmm. You know, the technical terminology used, like, was it Tithini, nurse?
Yes, yes.
And things like mm-hmm. that. You know, that just that actually ended up informing my understanding of Shaktism.
Interesting. Yeah. Nurse, mother, space, Korra.
Yes.
Right.
It's really when you get down to these root concepts, it's you're seeing the same when you get beyond the maybe the cultural model and you're looking at this, you're seeing almost identical language in some of these cases in these traditions. So, and I think it's so amazing that you wrote this book that is directly making this correlation, because it's something that I kind of came to the insight about that from your earlier mm-hmm. work. And then this work ends up following up on that. And it's interesting because we're talking about mother matter, you know, it's the prima materia mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. of alchemy. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is the prima materia of alchemy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like and that's the Mula Prakriti in the Eastern systems.
And I think psychologically it's that experience of Udania and Aporia, of not knowing, of being totally empty. Which is like the Buddhist notion of shunyata, you know?
Yes.
All of those things. Go ahead, though. You were in a flow there, and Janice, and I think I jumped in on it.
I like it when I prefer for you to jump in. I hear myself talk all the time. But what I was going to say is the interesting correlation that you were just making from a different angle of pure consciousness, light, the cosmic, the world soul, whether we call it Ekati, or Devi, and then also matter itself. So we're, you know, the two supposed poles, which from a non-dual perspective are really just different expressions or phases of the same thing. So the light and the matter are really one thing, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. one, like the unus mundus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us to sort of bring that connection, to live that connection, but it can only be done by entering into the alienated state that we find ourselves in and working it in from the bottom up, you could say. That's what we have to do as mortals, as the altar on which the infinite has sacrificed itself, you could say. Listen, I just hope that the work that I did trying to make connections between Tantra and theurgy can resonate at least a little bit with people to open us up to seeing the kind of connections that you guys are talking about. Because if it does, then I feel like it's been a work worth doing. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it absolutely is a success from my perspective, at least. I know it's helped me kind of work out some of these ideas. And make some connections. So if nothing else, it's helped me. So thank you.
And I think that deep down, I think that in the end, what's most important is people do the thing, you know, it's especially those of us who are maybe philosophically inclined, cerebrally inclined, that it's even more important that we get out there and we meditate or we do the theurgic rite, because that's what's going to lead us to that direct experience of reality. It's not the thinking about it, like you were saying earlier, but the direct experience, which enables us to realize with our own perception, non-dual reality.
Yep, I agree. And sometimes I think, well, no matter what, I sure have a pretty cover on the book. And to me, that's some satisfaction with that. Listen, it's a real pleasure to talk to both of you. And
yeah, it's always so great to talk to you. It's wonderful, and I want to thank you personally for just being such a your style of communication, your teaching style. It's so easy to learn from you. It's so easy to communicate with you. It's so pleasant. It's really nice. I mean,
I just feel every time you talk, I just feel so at ease and drawn into the subject matter. And I'm, you know, I've tried to model a little bit of my own teaching style on you, because I just feel like there's something about the way that you communicate these really deep, intricate things that makes that draws someone in and into the, in a Jungian sense, into the feeling tone of the matter. And so it's like, I'm actually feeling the material, even though we're dealing with this deep, profound stuff, you're making it so that I'm feeling it, not just thinking it.
I get that from talking to you too, guys. I'm feeling it too. So I appreciate our conversation. It's not isolated. It's a shared thing, and it wouldn't happen without all three of us doing it. So I really appreciate you asking me to talk about my book, and I hope this recording works really well for you, for me, for anybody who listens to it. We'll catch up next time, and stay in touch with me, okay?
Many thanks to Greg Shaw, a perennial favorite of ours, a master in his field. I would say probably the foremost expert on Iamblichus and Iamblichus's theology and insights are his exegesis of the work of Iamblichus is just, it's unparalleled. You can't touch Greg Shaw. He's amazing. And in addition to that, he's just such a nice person, such an insightful person. We absolutely love talking to him. And for me, his work, so invaluable in the formation of my own understanding of these matters, especially now that I have come to a point where I now see Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, and even late Hermetism, the kind we find in Alexandria, all to be forms of Platonism. At this point, I have come to see that there is a Platonic religion. And this Platonic religion is really the root of many other things, and at the bedrock of so much. I mean, it's the foundation of Western philosophy. I believe it's maybe the foundation even of at least esoteric Christianity, if not Christianity itself. As we discussed in the episode, the Mass is really a theurgic, right? You see it, of course, in Neoplatonism. All throughout, I don't think you can understand Gnosticism, classical Gnosticism, without understanding Platonism. So I guess I'm digressing a little bit here, but it's Greg Shaw's work that's kind of helped me to properly contextualize things in a way that no one else really has. And when you get out of the idea of the names of things, like, oh, this is Platonism, this is Gnosticism, or even this is Tantra, and you start just looking at reality, you know, and you realize that these were people interested in a direct engagement with spiritual reality in very subtle ways, in very deep ways. You know, it's not just, even the idea of philosophy meant something so much different to someone like Iamblichus than people of today. When we think of philosophy today, we think of some, you know, Kant and Hegel and all this stuff that's frankly is a drag. But really, philosophy originally meant the search for truth and the spiritual reconnection of man with the principles that underlie everything. And that ultimately, to the theurgists, was an active search, a search involving very shamanic means, very, very mystical means. And so I love what Greg is doing here, where he, through his own insights gained from decades of experience, has drawn parallels between tantric practice and Platonic practice. And this is something that really we in our podcasts have discussed with other people, the sort of, you could say, perennialist idea. And I think people misunderstand that as a syncretic attitude, when in reality, I don't think it's syncretism that's going on here. It's that when you look at things on a deep level in terms of the deep structures underlying everything, you start to see the big picture, the meta model,
And that really creates a reframing of perspective that informs everything you do and enables you to engage with things beyond the level of external forms. You start to get into the interiority of it all. And who better to lead us down that path than the wonderful Greg Shaw?
Nicely put. Yeah, very enjoyable conversation. Greg has a very powerful outlook on this topic, I think. He's really looking outside the box as far as what you find in academia a lot of times and making connections that haven't necessarily been publicly made before for like a larger audience. And I think he's right on track, and it's just wonderful to see. And his way of looking at things is just very refreshing. And you can hear it in the conversation. He's just really down to earth. I mean, he's this known, you know, world famous academic, an expert on this topic. And yet he's willing to just get together with us and just chat. Just really cool. So I always like talking to him. It's really fun and enlightening. He made some really excellent points that I'm going to really have to think about and take with me. And I hope it's the same for the listeners. I hope you guys got something valuable out of this. I'm willing to guess you probably did. So please check out his new book. It's called Hellenic Tantra, The Theurgic Platonism of Iamblichus. And if you haven't already, definitely check out his first book, Theurgy and the Soul.
Essential reading. I really, 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 really recommend both of these works. If you want to understand Iamblichus, you can't do any better than Greg.
Right. And you can't downplay the significance of Iamblichus or the influence of him. I mean, he's relatively unknown, but as you pointed out a minute ago, his influence was quite extraordinary. So it's definitely worth your time. If you're interested in esotericism, religion, philosophy, spirituality, as we're guessing you are since you're listening to this show, definitely look into it if you haven't already. And so, speaking of books, time to move on to our book review segment. What do you have for us today?
I have an interesting book called Journey to Gorakhpur, An Encounter with Christ Beyond Christianity by a man named John Moffat. This book was published by Holt Reinhardt Winston in 1972. Now, Mr. Moffat was a monastic member of the Order of Ramakrishna for 25 years and then later became a Catholic. So in this book, he gives sketches of Indian saints, describes Indian devotion. He made holy visits to holy men and participated in religious ceremonies in India that, especially at this time, were really unknown in the West. He talks about Gandhi and Ramakrishna, but then he also relates it to his own mystical journey as a Catholic. So it's very interesting because he completely immersed himself in the world of Sanatana Dharma in India. And he goes through, there's so much here. You know, he talks about Swami Vivekananda. He talks about Ramakrishna. He describes the worship of the mother in tantric practice. He also provides some examples, some translations of Indian poetry in here. He really just correlates and correlates the religious journey towards spiritual ascent in both East and West. So I think it's really interesting, the subtitle, an Encounter with Christ Beyond Christianity. I think it's a beautiful thing, and this book is just so interesting because it's coming from, it's such a sincerely written book, but it's such a deep book, and it's such a deep explication of and exploration of Indian spirituality and philosophy And then this is coming from a Westerner who in turn, this ended up enriching and deepening his own understanding of the religion of his background. So it's very perennialist in that way too. And you know, this was one of those things which I just found in a bookstore one day, and I thought, oh, this seems such an interesting thing to explore. And he talks about even, you know, the different migrations of people through India. He talks about the different approaches towards the understanding of the self, of devotion, you know, explores the concept of intuitive wisdom. He talks about his own physical journey. He talks about the relationship between the person and the community, which is really insightful. He even discusses the idea of, you know, religious discipline, mystical discipline, you know, the idea of living a disciplined spiritual life and how this is consistent in the different traditions. And you're not dealing with someone who's just a scholar who's doing comparative religious study from an external point of view. You're dealing with somebody who literally was in an Indian monastic order actively practicing, which is invaluable because you have the voice of someone who was a mystic as well as a scholar. I had never heard of this book before. And when I came across it, it's really interesting. I mean, on the back cover, even there's this cool image on the one hand of Jesus's face from the Turin shroud. And then next to it, it shows an image of Brahma from one of the temples. And on the back, there's a piece of his poetry, which I'll read since it's short. Between me and the moving world's variable play of light and sound, you interpose, not less revealed, because too instant to be known. Between me and my clearest thought, my fiercest love, my closest prayer, still you contrive to penetrate the crux of now, the core of here. Though I could cross creation out, dissolve all elements in one, your presence would unvarying wait where from forever it has been. The silent mover of the play, the focus of its myriad parts, fashioning for the world and me a wholeness from our opposites. I think we could stand, especially today, to examine that type of perspective that doesn't cut things up into little parts or create these hard boundaries and instead looks at the essential core of true and deep acquaintance with the divine. And this book does it well, and I thought it would be a nice sort of bookend, as it were, to this discussion with Greg, which from a different point of view kind of approaches a similar idea. And if you think about even the geographical transmission of many ideas, especially a couple thousand years ago along the Silk Road, many people aren't necessarily aware of the Gandharvan culture, which was a Greek settlement in Pakistan, where you can see in the remnants of the Gandharvan culture a fusion between Greek artistic, sculptural, and religious ideas and Indian religious concepts. So a well-known example of this is an image of the Buddha that has Hercules sheltering the Buddha, and the Buddha depicted in the Greek classical form and with attributes that Apollo was depicted with. And it's, you know, it's interesting because from the Gandharvan culture, then Hercules ended up becoming a bodhisattva, a dharma protector in tantric Buddhism, under a different name. So this idea, whether we're talking about what Greg was talking about or Mr. Moffat, who wrote this book, there is something to it. There is an understanding that in the how in the spiritual realm there is a fundamental unity between things. And that doesn't mean that everything is everything, but there's a certain way in which there is that unity. And I think that it would be useful for us to try and move beyond the externals into the immediacy of interiority, and the immediacy of the direct experience, which can be had through meditation, contemplation, theurgy, and whether you're approaching it through Raja Yoga, the mental yoga, or whether you're approaching it through theurgy or whether you're approaching it through meditation, such as what you find in Dzogchen, you can come to the same place from different roads.
So yeah, it is a favorite topic of mine for sure. And this was just a great interview. And this sounds like a really interesting book, actually. What was the name of it again?
Journey to Gorakhpur, Gorakhpur, An Encounter with Christ Beyond Christianity by John Moffat. It was published by Holt Reinhardt and Winston. I don't think it's been republished, but I believe I looked it up on the internet, and it can be found for a reasonable price if you look around. It was published in 1972. It's really a wonderful book. I mean, he quotes from The Cloud of Unknowing, but then he quotes from the Upanishads and the Dhammapada, and then he quotes from St. Catherine of Genoa. And so he's, you know, I think even Thomas Merton is mentioned at some point here. So it's really cool because there's a fluidic continuity and yet an intellectual acumen that this book's been written with. So it's very nice because you get that mystical experience coming from personal insight combined with the sort of intellectual sharpness and rigor that comes from a true student of these matters.
Cool, man. All right. I think that's good for today. Thank you everyone for listening. We truly appreciate your support and your listenership. Feel free to like and subscribe in all the different places, and we will see you in the next episode.